Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So, just to continue on, and I'm not going to flip around all over the place, just for what's useful, using this translation as a basis. So, yesterday I was mentioning about effort and exactly what it means, and it seems to be more accurate and helpful for people to call it just the right restraint of the five hindrances. In other words, to see what we're supposed to be doing with this. And now, what's the purpose of this? To restrain, to let go, to stop, so those hindrances can be abandoned. And pointing out the connection there between each one of these factors of the Eightfold Path, and here the factor from right, correct, or whatever skillful restraint, and how that leads to the possibility of mindfulness. Because four focuses of mindfulness, you can see that I didn't translate it as the four foundations of mindfulness, because this particular teaching of the Buddha was actually showing you where to put that mindfulness, where actually your mindfulness can be focused so that you can see the important things of life and the things of life which lead to liberation. And, of course, we first of all, the four focuses of mindfulness lead in one direction only. And it is just really almost, you wonder why good monks even say that it's the only path, because there's no way in the world that that can be sustained by logic, by evidence. The only path is actually, you can see that in places like verse 37 to the Dhammapada, this is the only path, there is no other, for the purification of beings, referring to the Eightfold Path. The way to enlightenment consistently is always Eightfold Path. So, and as Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, in his translation, pointed out, that same word, that word which was some people translate as the only path, is ekayana. Even if you go into the intricacies of Pali grammar, if it was the only path, it would be ekayana. This is ekayana. It's a one going. It's a different compound, similar. The difference between a long A and a short A, basically, but it's totally different. And fortunately, two suttas later, do you actually hear the only other place where that word is used in the suttas by the Buddha. And that place is where they describe the results of karma. And the way the Buddha described it, and when you see words used, not in a metaphysical or philosophical context, but like a down-to-earth context, in the terms of a simile which we can relate to, instead of just thinking about, it was if a person is walking on a path in a jungle and there's no left turn, there's no right turn, it just goes in that one direction and there's a pit of burning coals at the end of that path, then the Buddha knows if he keeps on going, he's going to fall into that pit of coals. There's no sort of left turn, no right turn, no U-turn, it's going to lead there. And that word was the same word which he used for this four focuses of mindfulness. If you keep going on, it just leads in that direction. But it's not the only path. All the others are equally necessary. And I'll point that out probably later on in this class today, when we go further on to those sequences from the Anguttara Nikaya. But first of all, disappearance of physical and mental suffering, attainment of the true way, the realization of Nibbana. And I mentioned that every one of these four Satipatthanas, they always require the prerequisite, what you have to do before you can truly do the mindfulness. And the first is having restrained those five hindrances. Then what you are doing is not just mindfulness, it's not secular mindfulness, it's right mindfulness. It is mindfulness which has, it's not saying that secular mindfulness is bad or wrong or not helpful, of course it's helpful. But to qualify as this part seven of the Eightfold Path, it's done when you've very strongly weakened the five hindrances. And then you contemplate these four things. First of all, the body, this physical thing, the body, but you can see the second one there, the Vedana, which many of you, if you've been to meditation retreats, you'd have come across that you contemplate feeling. Now, first of all, that word feeling is used for emotional feelings, the fact that I can feel the cup. And in the suttas, it just, they say there's the quality of experience of being pleasant, unpleasant, or in between. And in Pali, it's not that you're contemplating that quality of experience, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. You are just focusing on experience itself. The fact that, you know, you have here and now the experience of listening to me or seeing the reaction in your mind. And it just happens that those experiences, you know, come in, if you like, three flavors. So, you know, you are, it's like you are contemplating ice cream. Yeah, ice cream comes in three flavors, chocolate, vanilla, strawberry, maybe a few others. But what you're really contemplating is the ice cream. So it's the experience, and that is much closer to actually even the word, Vedana, Vedeti. What is experience? How does experience happen? There's three types of experience, but it's just the sensory experience which we're focusing on and learning about and what actually is, where it comes from. So, and obviously the third is the mind, the citta. And to be even aware of the mind is just, you need to really have a very deep meditation to even know what the mind is. And here I bring in one of the similes, and this is based on the Buddha simile of the goldsmith. The Buddha simile of the goldsmith was that if you want to know the properties of gold, you have to purify it first of all, to take out the other elements which may be in that gold, things like tin and silver, which means it's not 100% proof. You take off those ones so that you can actually find what gold really is, its properties. If there's some other impurities in there, of course you will never be able to know the true quality of gold. And the simile which I developed to make it a little bit more interesting was of the mysterious emperor. So there was an emperor who had enormous power, but no one knew who that emperor was. Because every time the emperor appeared in public, the emperor was clothed head to toe, fully covered in five garments. The emperor had boots which went up to the thighs, and had trousers, the bottom of which overlapped the top of the boots and went high up to the waist. And the emperor had a jacket which overlapped the top of the trousers went high up to the neck, and sleeves which went down to the wrists. The fourth garment was some gloves, which totally covered the hands and overlapped the top of the sleeves. And last of all, had a helmet on. And the helmet covered the whole of the face and overlapped the top of the jacket. So there was no part of the emperor's skin or face which was visible. And I was very careful there to not say he, she, or it, because no one knew what gender that emperor was, never knew whether it was Ang Mo, or whether it was Teichu or Hokkien, or where it was from, or Sri Lankan, or Thai, because they couldn't see the face. Didn't know whether it was old or young, didn't even know it was human, because never even saw it. But the emperor inside was very, very powerful. And that simile stands for your six components of existence. Thank you. That was the deliberate mistake today, to make sure that people were paying attention. It stands for, not the six senses, because only five. So that was the five khandhas. Or was it six? Were you paying attention? So what is it there? You have the boots is one, pants is two, jacket, gloves, and helmet, and the emperor inside. So it stands for the five senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. With the mind, the emperor, inside. So, what is this mind? Which is always seems to be covered with these five senses. Do you really know this mind by itself? Or the only time you know it is when it's looking at and figuring out, connected with, entangled with the five senses. So the only way to understand who that emperor is, the mind, the jitta, is to take off all those clothes. See what's underneath. So we undress the emperor to find out who is this very powerful being, sort of at the heart of all this thing called me. And that's what we do with our meditation. We take away the five senses until all that's left is this mind, this jitta. And then, like the goldsmith, we can understand the nature of gold, the nature of this jitta, of this mind. The point is, but first of all, we have to learn how to take away the five physical senses. And that is the job of the meditation. And the first place, I can say this now. The first time you can really understand something of what the mind is just on the ninth stage of Anapanasati, to experience the jitta. And that corresponds to this nimitta, this light which appears in the mind. And it's the interesting stuff which happens there. One of them is this young man from Kuala Lumpur, a member of the Buddhist Gem Fellowship, who they assigned to me as my attendant during a retreat I gave there some years ago. And he came up to me and said he got quite peaceful in his meditation, and he saw this nimitta, this light, but it wasn't bright and pure. It was all dirty and blotchy, like a t-shirt which needed to be put in the washing machine. And I explained to him, he said, when you first see your mind, your jitta, in that deep meditation where the five senses start to get so weak that the mind dominates. That if you have been living a pure life, a good life, a generous, a kind life, forgiving people, then you will find your nimitta is very beautiful. But if you have been slack with your precepts, if you've been lying or cheating or messing around, doing things which you shouldn't have been doing, then when you see your nimitta, you'll be like a dirty rag which needs putting in the washing machine, and you're so upset. And he admitted, oh yeah, my precepts, I was not keeping them before this retreat. I say, well, that's, you know, it's true. So this is actually where you start to see the power of virtue, how it influences your mind. And on the opposite there are some people in this world who are just so pure-hearted. And you can ask them for anything. They never sort of criticize or blame. They're always ready to help at a moment's notice, do a lot of charity work, and just, they really are wonderful people, you know, to have supporting you. And this one lady, I've known her for such a long time, and I knew that if she comes on a retreat, something must happen. And of course it did, because of her purity, of her conduct, never thinking of herself, serving, looking after others, and having the chance to meditate. She became really peaceful and got some really nice, beautiful nimittas. I knew that was going to happen, because you could predict that, because, you know, she was a strong supporter. But also, interestingly, I asked her, now once you started getting some nice meditations, what about trying, what's my earliest memory? And so, you know, to get the past lives coming up. And when you get the earliest memory, the first thing she did actually quite shook her. She was very concerned, because this was many years ago, before Jhana Grove was built, that she had this vision of her as a baby, a newborn baby. It was in this life. But when you have these recollections of past life, they're vivid, they're real. And, you know, you have no doubt that this is actually me many years ago. And she looked up at her mother, who was breastfeeding her, and she was devastated. The woman breastfeeding her wasn't her mum. And that really shook her. This person she'd grown up with, believing there was her mother, wasn't. So she came up to me and said, what's happening, Ajahn Brahm? This is, you know, really devastating. Is there something my mother hasn't told me? And so the only thing I could say to her is, after the retreat is finished, her mother was still alive, just go and ask her. And so she did that. She told me what happened. She went to her mum, just ordinary conversation, and, Mum, is there anything you haven't told me? Her mother was saying, what do you mean? Are you really my mum? Now imagine that was your child and they said that to you. What's going on? Why are you saying that? And then she explained about the experience she had. And mother, the person she thought was her mother, said, what did that woman look like who was breastfeeding you? And she gave this description, because you do have, in these memories you have, you know, after the five hindrances have disappeared, they're very strong. And you can remember them pretty easily. And so she described this person in great detail. And her mother was just astounded. How on earth can you remember that? They came from a high-born family, and so her mother hired a wet nurse. She said, I am your mum. I gave birth to you. But in those first months of life, we hired a wet nurse to feed you. And you just described her in perfect detail. How you can remember that is just astounding to me, said the mum. So this is actually just some of the stuff which you can get when you get a very, very pure mind. And you use that pure mind to be able to get into some deep meditation. So when I was saying it's what you do before you get on the cushion is really important. That virtue, that generosity, that kindness, that general goodness. You know good people when you see them. They're not playing around being good. They're just really nice people to be with. And anyway, so that gives you some power which you make use of in the meditation to actually to find out what the mind actually is. And the mind objects is as many of the Westerners are very critical, which is sometimes it's difficult to live with Westerners, but they really keep you on the ball. In Thailand, they will just say, sadhu, 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 even if you gave a rubbish talk. Because they had faith and they just said, all right, you can't criticize monastics. And then again, even sometimes in Singapore or in Malaysia, they will probably sometimes do the same in traditional temples. But when you go to places like the Buddhist Fellowship, you can't get away with that with people like Angie and others. They'll be making a mistake, they'll point it out, which is great. It's troublesome. And you have to go and just find out what I've done wrong. But it's good because it keeps the monks and the nuns on their toes. So anyway, so that means and it ties in with your idea of, you know, just really looking at these texts and really getting into it and just exploring them. And some of the things which were there before, they do need to be amended to get the Dhamma and meditation really strong again. And to have bhikkhunis as well as bhikkhus who have giving equal respect. So anyway, so the mindfulness of breathing. So when the Buddha was teaching the Satipatthana and the mindfulness of the body, he also included the mindfulness of breathing as the very first of the practices of Satipatthana. And the fact it was put as the first practice is also really interesting and important. So for mindfulness of breathing, you go down to a secluded place. If you have read the translations, you find word to word for translations, or you go to a quiet forest or a mountain grove or a cave or a charnel ground. How many of you have gone to a charnel ground to do mindfulness of breathing? Do you know what a charnel ground is? That's where they burn bodies. I went to a charnel ground in Thailand because, I think I mentioned this to you earlier, that was the only place in Thailand where I could get some peace and quiet. Because I remember when I was on my tudong wandering around Thailand, I just set up my little umbrella and a little mosquito net, and then I was only there for a few minutes, and then a Thai woman came, elderly woman. She didn't know if I could speak the local language or not, but she gave me three gifts. It was a piece of paper, a pencil, and a bottle of Coca-Cola. And I knew straight away, it wasn't gifts, it was a deal. If I wrote some numbers on the piece of paper, I could take the Coca-Cola. Because I thought that these forest monks could actually tell the lottery numbers. And that's all they were really, especially the wandering monks, that's what they were really concerned about. So instead of that, you go to the charnel grounds where they burn bodies. Because there, those Thai villagers, they wouldn't go near that place. They were scared of ghosts. And people would ask me, are you scared of ghosts, Ajahn Brahm? And especially those first years I was a monk, I said, no, why not? Well, because I can't speak Thai, I don't know what they're talking about. So imagine you go to a charnel ground and the guys go, rah, 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 rah. And I said, well, I can't understand Thai, sorry. That's only messing you around, but anyway, One thing which I did, I always like going off on tangents. One thing which I did find, with ghosts are afraid of human beings, especially monks and nuns, anyone in brown robe. How to understand that is, again, I always try and find similes. Elephants are afraid of mice. So they say. I don't know why. Well, what harm could a mouse do to an elephant? But an elephant can step on a mouse and crush it as easy as anything. However, for some reason, elephants are afraid of mice. And that's so similar to human beings and ghosts. Ghosts are lower realms. They haven't got that much power. But they have the power to scare us, like a mouse running around so fast. It's the speed which causes the elephant to be a bit afraid. And the ghost can't do much to a human being, to the point that if ever, no ghosts in this compound, I keep them out. There's hardly any sort of people die in Australia anyway. There's hardly anybody here. It's an, you know, pretty much, okay, there's indigenous people, but there's such a small population, such a huge area. So the ghosts are free to go anywhere. It's not the same in Singapore because, you know, it's you know, a lot of sort of not much space for the ghosts to roam. But anyway, that they are afraid of human beings. So there was, in this monastery over in Thailand a long time ago, there was a gentleman, it was a monk, I know him very well, but he disrobed after a while. But he told me he was in this monastery of, it was actually Ajahn Tate's monastery, one of my favorite monks. And he was in this monastery meditating. It was well known as a charnel ground, there was many ghosts there. And one day he was meditating, and he felt somebody, the idiom, that literally just tugged his foot. I was going to say pull his leg, but that's an idiom for doing a trick on you. But this was somebody who was actually tugged his foot. And he thought, because he was a bit sleepy, he thought it was some heavenly being assisting him. But then it kept interfering with his meditation, getting peaceful, and then it would interfere with him. And then he realized it was a ghost because it would always be accompanied by a bad smell. So if it's a bad smell, then that, okay, that's a ghost. If there's no smell at all, it's a ghost with deodorant. That's only a joke, they don't have deodorants. So it always came with a bad smell. He was kind to it because he knew it couldn't do any harm, but it was just annoying. So that's when I remember him telling me that one day he smelt the ghost coming to his hut where he was meditating. And he started to be firm with the ghost. And that's how to treat ghosts. Say, ghost, stop messing around. If you want to come into my hut, you meditate next to me. Here's a cushion for you. You sit here or stop messing around. And the ghost never came back. So if ever you see any ghosts, be firm with them. That's the way to treat them. They're lower beings, so you tell them, you know, and they'll respect you. Oh, no, I'll tell other ghost stories later on. Supposed to be mindfulness of beings, not mindfulness of ghosts. So a quiet, secluded place. A secluded place can be in a cupboard in your office. Because sometimes we don't have much space. So find a quiet place, a secluded place, where you can be alone. And sit down comfortably. In the suttas it says sit down cross-legged with your back straight, which is great if you were born in India and you haven't had any football accidents or motorbike accidents. Because sometimes people just can't sit like that. personally, I'm fortunate that I ordained when I was 23, and so when I ordained, my body was still supple, and there wasn't any chairs to sit down on, so I sat down always on cross-legged on the floor for, it was 7 years before I went to visit UK, visit my family. And I had to sit down for I don't know how many hours on an aircraft seat, and that tortured me. I never sat on a seat for 7 years, and now I had to have my legs dangling down. I said, can't I sit in the aisle or in some cupboard somewhere and just so I can cross my legs? I said, no. So that was, I realized the other way. People who've been sitting on chairs for such a long time and us who sit on the floor, I can understand because I was sitting on the floor and I had to sit on a chair and I just got the opposite. So anyway, so you had to sit comfortably, and comfortably is important. So that's why I translated it as comfortably. Give priority to establishing mindfulness. And once you've done all those things, then mindfully you breathe in, mindfully you breathe out. When the in-breath and out-breath are long, you're aware that they are long. When the in-breath and out-breath are short, you're aware that they are short. Then you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. And then you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. Now that's sometimes when people question, why do I take away the repetition? If you actually read or even read out the full translation of that, it becomes, when the in-breath is long, you're aware that it is long. When the in-breath is short, you're aware that it is, you're breathing in a short breath. That when the in-breath is, see, it gets complicated. This is when you do the whole thing. And I'm not reading out here, I'm reading out as it is in the usual translations. When the in-breath, when you're breathing in and in, when you're breathing in an in-breath, you know you're breathing in a short in-breath. No, sorry, no, as it goes. When you're breathing in a short in-breath, that you know you're breathing in a short in-breath. When you're breathing out a short out-breath, you understand, you're aware that you're breathing out a short out-breath. When you're breathing in a long in-breath, you're aware you're breathing in a long in-breath. When you're breathing out a long out-breath, you're aware you're breathing out a long out-breath. So long and complicated. So you just say, when in-breath and out-breath are long, you're aware that they are long. In-breath and out-breath are short, you're aware they are short. So this is why the translation should always make it easy, user-friendly for people. The problem was, sometimes my in-breath wasn't long, wasn't short, it was sort of in between. So that really made me confused. How long must it be to qualify as that step of the Anapanasati? How short should it be? But what happens if you have a middle breath? That means you're not doing Anapanasati because that's not included. And of course, after much looking at these instructions and then understanding them, what it really means is when you're first aware of the breath, sometimes you only see a bit of the breath, just enough to know it's long or it's short. Similar to the walking meditation. When you first start walking, sometimes you just know the left foot is moving or the right foot is moving. And little by little, your awareness grows until you can see the whole of one foot moving from beginning to end. The whole of the right step, the whole of the left step. So this is where you start, and from here, the in-breath and out-breath are long. You're aware they're long. In-breath and out-breath are short. It's giving you something, the length of your breath, to make it interesting. And in many meditation traditions, instead of just noticing the length of the breath, sometimes we even count the breath. Breathing in one, breathing out one. Breathing in two, breathing... Sorry. Breathing in one, breathing out one. Breathing in two. Breathing in three, breathing out three. And sometimes you do counting. And there's so many different ways of counting. Or you use what they call a like a mantra, a parikama in Thai, it's borigam. And the one which was very common in the forest tradition was Budho. Well, how you do that is you breathe in, Bud, out, ho, Budho, Budho, Budho. And for someone who is brought up in that tradition, that they revere that word. It's a powerful word for them, which means it's very easy, relatively easy, to actually to keep the awareness of that word with the breath, breathing in, Bud, breathing out, ho. But you know that when I first came to Australia, it didn't really cut it because people didn't have that sort of faith in the Buddha and especially that word. So I started to try other words to actually to get people easy to be able to keep their attention on the breath. And one of the words I tried was breathing in. You recite to yourself, shut. Breathing out, up. Shut up. I was serious about it because a lot of time people think too much. So that didn't work. I think I already mentioned that one of the other ones because somebody asked me about doing death contemplation. Death contemplation actually can scare you, but it can also just allow you to let things go and all the things we worry about, most of them, just we have to let them go. So it was again from a Thai tradition. They said, like, die, nah. So it becomes, I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure, with your breath. But it's a bit much, so that didn't really work. But that really does work if you want to do the walking meditation with I will die, that's for sure. So what you do there, you start your walking meditation, and maybe you start with your right leg moving. As you move it forward, I will die. The left leg, that's for sure. And people think it's a joke at first. It's funny. I will die, that's for sure. And then after a while, they get through the embarrassment or the fun or jokey mind. And they realize that of all the teachings, that's the one you can have no doubt about. That is true, no matter what religion, faith, what teacher, you know that that's true, I will die, that's for sure. And if you really get into it, then you get to fear. Keep on walking, I will die, that's for sure, I'm not ready to die. I'm too young to die, I'm only 93, 94. How old is Mahathir? How old is he? I'm too young to die, to retire. So, you get through fear. And after you get through fear, you have this wonderful feeling of peace. I will die, that's for sure. So many worries, graspings, things which you carry around with you. I'm going to die. What's the point of carrying these things and worrying about these things? I'm going to die anyway one day. So I'll let them go. You get a lot of peace that way. And of course, it's very useful. It works so beautifully when I started teaching in Indonesia. Because in Bahasa, the words are mati pasti. Mati, you did right foot, mati pasti. Mati pasti. Pasti mati, yeah. But anyway, that worked very, very well. But for some people, that is difficult. So the one I settled on, instead of long, short, or in between, which seems to actually work very beautifully for many Westerners, is as you breathing in peace. Something which is really means something to you. Somewhere you can feel peace. You know what peace is. Breathing in peace. Breathe out, let go. Because the exhale is an automatic letting go. So it fits. Breathing in peace. breathe out, let go. But you don't just say the words. You remember their meaning. You visualize it. You know, whether it's, you know, peace coming in a sort of, in a white dove coming up your nostrils into your mind or whatever. You know, give it some texture, give it some meaning, not just a word, but you feel, what is peace? It comes in and breathe out, let go. If you want to do it as a health meditation, I don't know, like breathing in energy, breathing in positivity, breathing out the sickness, breathing out illness, breathing out negativity. Whatever you do, don't complicate it too much. Choose something and just go for it. Breathing in health, breathing out tumor, breathing in health. And you can imagine it, visualize it, feel it. And then it's really positive. It actually works. But you know, the main reason is just to get used to your breath. And then the third, experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. And I'm sure that some of you will say, what it means, it says, sabbakaya pati sangvedi, that's your body. And that is a classical case of word-for-word translation when it does not mean that. It is another of these idioms. And the Buddha actually explains it in the other Anapanasati Sutta. This is from the Satipatthana. And there it says very clearly that sabbakaya refers to the breath. He calls it one of the bodies amongst, you know, the bodies. Just the same way in English we have a body of evidence, a body of truth. A body of truth doesn't mean something with arms and legs. And to me as a meditator, it's how can you just be aware of the breath going in and out, long or short or whatever, and then go back to your body. You tranquilize your body, trying to get rid of most of it, trying to transcend the body, not to go back to it again. So it's obvious, and this is a natural progress, as you become more and more aware of your body. Sorry, as you become more and more aware of your breath, you actually see the whole of the breath from the beginning to end. I use a finger here. And I always have to remember, I'm not going to say my finger's going from left to right. That's for me, but for you it's from right to left. The finger goes from right to left. I can see the whole process of that finger. That's the whole of an in-breath in this simile. And it's whole from the left to the right. See the whole of the out-breath. That's that third stage of Anapanasati. You just see the whole of the breath without missing any of it. And it's not that hard to do because it becomes very beautiful. It's interesting. And it was, again, just on walking meditation that when your foot moves, you see the very beginning of a movement of the foot. You see right to the end until the step is finished. The whole of just one left step. One right step. Your awareness is fully focused just on moving the feet. Your awareness is fully focused on just the breathing, nothing else. And yeah, sure, when you're doing your walking meditation, by that stage, of course you can sort of hear sounds, but they don't really disturb you, like a long distance away. Yeah, you're still seeing, you know, the body length in front of you, but it's not really disturbing, it's just background. Because the main thing which is dominating your mind is the feelings of moving your feet when you're walking meditation. The main thing which is dominating your mind when you're breathing is just the in-breath and the out-breath. And learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. Now here the breath is a kaya sankhara. Kaya sankhara means it's, you know, caused by the body. It's a body thing. And that, again, this is the whole of the breath, it's the whole of the kaya sankhara. But you don't. You learn how to calm the breath. You don't do the calming of the breath. Because you find your breath calms naturally. Why is it calming naturally when you're doing the breath meditation? It is because just like when you've been driving your car and you park it, the engine is still running, but it's just humming along. You're not using so much petrol. You're calming the engine down because you're not metabolizing that much when you are breathing. Basically, your body doesn't need so much oxygen. So it's a natural phenomena, not something you do, something you experience. Your breath calms down, doesn't need so much oxygen, and it slows down. So that's the calming of the breath as you breathe in and out. And just in the Satipatthana, just as a skilled painter is aware whether they're making a long brush stroke or a short brush stroke, so too when the in-breath is long, you're aware that it is long. Do you remember that simile in the suttas? It's not there. The simile they have there, like somebody who is running a lathe to actually just to make circular pieces of wood, like bedposts or railings. It's a lathe turner. These days, it's all electric lathes. It just goes in one direction. But I was fortunate enough to again become a monk in a time when there was no electricity in the village. And so we actually made a lathe. And I used that lathe. It was a big piece of bamboo, a long piece of bamboo. It was secured, you know, into the ground so one end wouldn't move. And on the top of the bamboo was a rope, and it was on a pedal. So when you push down on the pedal, the sort of the string went down, and when you released the pedal, it went up again, up and down, like a sewing machine. And the rope was wound around a piece of wood between two nails. So as you push down, the wood went around. When you released the foot, it went in the opposite direction, so you can make the incisions on the piece of wood. So to me, when I saw that simile, yeah, I understood that because I knew the old lathes in the villages before electricity. But people these days wouldn't understand what that means. So that's one of the reasons why on these translations, keep the meaning, but actually change some of the words. A short brushstroke or a long brushstroke, if you're a painter. So that's what I do. Now, I'm going to just flip and give poor Eileen a problem. So can you go down to the Anapanasati Sutta? Because that's part of the Satipatthana. And that is the only place where you have that simile. So if you can go down to Nibbana through Anapanasati. Not that far down. You got it? Nibbana, there we go, you got it, yay! There it is. Now this is actually from the Anapanasati Sutta. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is a great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it completes the four focus of mindfulness. And you pause there because the Anapanasati completes the four focuses of mindfulness. Anapanasati is Satipatthana. Sometimes people say, no, Anapanasati, that's Samatha practice. Satipatthana is Vipassana practice. That's not what the Buddha said. The Buddha said, when you do mindfulness of breathing, it completes the four focuses of mindfulness. When the four focuses of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they complete the seven enlightenment factors. When the seven enlightenment factors are developed and cultivated, they complete true knowledge and deliverance, awakening. And after a long sort of inner sort of contemplation, decided, instead of calling it enlightenment, just, you know, for some Bodhi, you know, it's called it awakening. Because that's a bit closer to the meaning, the original meaning of Bujati, which is to wake up. And it also implies that mindfulness and stillness, which gives your awareness really strong, powerful mindfulness. So it is like, you know, you come out from the mist and you can see clearly. You go outside and you can see the flowers for the first time, like they've been cleaned up. It's your awareness is now strong. You're wakening up to reality, what's really out there. So anyway, enlightenment can be just a little bit too intellectual for me. You know, just you're enlightened, you've read, oh yeah, you understand, but it's not that an experience of really, really strong awareness. So, how does mindfulness of breathing, developed and cultivated, complete the four focuses of mindfulness? When the in-breath and out-breath are long, you're aware that they are long. When the in-breath and out-breath are short, you're aware that they are short. When you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out, when you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out, on those occasions you are mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances. Oh, I should stop there. You're mindful of the body, even though you're looking at the breath. Because it says in a moment, the breath is the body. On those occasions you are mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. In and out breathing is regarded by the Buddha as a body in the category of bodies. That is why on that occasion, a meditator abides mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energy, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. And I've even got the little note by myself. Experience the whole body, sabbakaya patisangvedi, thus refers to experience the whole of the breath. Now I'll go on to the next factors. When you learn to experience joy as you breathe in and out, when you learn to experience pleasure as you breathe in and out, the piti and sukha, which comes from the breath. And this is not, again, something you do. Why does this happen? You're breathing in and out and it becomes delightful. Why? It is because you are doing very, very little at this point. You're experiencing this breath and it just stays there. It's subtle. And because it's subtle and it's staying there, your energy is now going into knowing. Your energy wakens up mindfulness. When mindfulness gets strong, there's a natural happiness comes. Many of you may, ordinary people, may experience that, at least in the old days, when you first wake up in the morning, before you have your first cup of coffee, you're a pain in the neck to others. You got no happiness because haven't slept well, gotta go to. But then, you know, you have your first cup of coffee or tea or whatever, and then you're bright and happy. Unfortunately, it's why some of our young people take drugs when they go to parties. It makes them happy. Their energy. It's a shame you have to use those drugs to get happy. But, oh, I don't mind telling this story. It was one of our monks when, I can't really say who he is, but he's a building monk and he's now in Newbury. But he's a really nice monk, he won't mind. But he went on pilgrimage to India and he got, you know, some sort of flu or some sickness. And, you know, as people sometimes do on pilgrimage, and laying a bit, feeling terrible. So the only doctor they could get, this Indian doctor, he said, oh, take some of these. He was a proper doctor, you know, a GP. And after he'd taken these pills, you know, he was out of bed, feeling great, doing his washing, and other people's washing as well. The other monks with him. I said, what did you give me? It was, I think, methamphetamine. If he really knew what he was taking, but it worked. At least for him. A quick boost of energy, got his body feeling positive, and just whatever was going on in his body, just the energy just blasted it away. Interesting anyway. But anyway, you notice that happiness and joy when you get a boost of energy. Now, instead of having coffee or tea or any of these other drugs, this is a natural form of energy which comes when mindfulness gets very strong. And you see just the most beautiful concrete in the world. So many stories about just seeing beauty where you didn't expect to see beauty. And now you're watching your breath with energy, with powerful mindfulness. It looks beautiful. You're experiencing piti sukha with the breath. When I started as a monk, I thought you're not supposed to enjoy it. It's supposed to be some asceticism. If you're enjoying it, you must be doing something wrong. Suffering. You should be suffering. Venerable Chanda, suffering. That's ridiculous. That's horrible. But then you started getting into meditation, you started becoming happy. And Dhammacetya Sutta, haven't got it here, but there, when King Prasenadi went to the monastery, the Jetavana monastery, he remarked to the Buddha, in this monastery the monks are always happy and smiling. Yes, that's what you can expect. People who meditate and get insight, they're going to be happy. Because this is what happens when your energies start to really get up through meditation. You experience piti and sukha. Now, the third, well, this is number seventh factor of number two. When you learn to experience the mental formation of piti sukha, that gives you a clue. It's not the breath which is beautiful or delightful of pleasure, it's just the breath. It's not the piece of concrete which I saw was beautiful. It was just the mental formation. It's how the mind experiences the breath. It's what the mind adds to it. If you have a positive mind, wow, everything is just so gorgeous. That baked bean which I tasted was most delicious. That was a mental formation of a baked bean. Not the physical one. If it was in the baked bean, then everyone could taste it. It was how I experienced a baked bean. That's where the piti sukha comes from. You're going from the physical feeling of the breath to how the mind experiences the breath. It's one of the reasons why that sometimes people say, well, the breath is disappearing. It's not disappearing. You're beginning to see it through another sense door. Not through the fifth sense door, physical touch, but through the mind door, a kaya sankara. So, when the breath starts to disappear, it's not disappearing. You're just seeing it through another sense. The physical sense is turning off. The mental sense, the sixth sense, is turning on. So it's so beautiful. And then you experience that mental formation as you breathe in and out, and you calm that mental formation. It just happens. You get more and more subtle as you breathe in and out. On that occasion, you're mindful of experience, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose of mindful. For being mindful of the pleasure associated with this stage of breath meditation is being mindful of experience. And I would just pause on the word pleasure. Because I don't know how many times we said, what? You're supposed to experience pleasure in meditation? Aren't you going to get attached? You're supposed to do this. Actually, you do get attached. And later on, in here somewhere, you'll show that when you attach to the pleasure of meditation, only four things can happen. The results of being attached to meditation. Stream meaning, once returning, non-returning, full enlightenment. In other words, you're supposed to be attached. It's a raft. Don't abandon the raft until it's got to the other side. In the simile of the raft. You don't jump off it midstream. So you're attached to it, it's got a purpose. Use it for that purpose, and then afterwards it will disappear. But right now, you're enjoying the pleasure of that. And it's 5 o'clock now, but I'll just go and give you the quick preview of what's coming in the meditation hall close to you tomorrow. Here. So then you experience the nimitta as you breathe in and out. This is what it said, you're experiencing the citta. And how do you experience the citta, this mind? How it appears when the 5 senses start to disappear. And what's left is this thing which we call nimitta. And sometimes, again, this is well sort of recorded in sort of commentaries. But then people say, well, where is it in the suttas? Where is it in the word of the Buddha? And I must admit I did have an argument with Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi because it's right there front and center in the Upakalesa Sutta. So if you read the Upakalesa Sutta, the English translation by the Pali Text Society, you'll miss it. Because it says the different problems with being able to maintain awareness on that thing. And I said, well, the Pali word for that thing is nimitta. So, you know, why don't you put nimitta in there instead of that thing? Because people will look at that and say, nimitta's not mentioned anywhere in the suttas. So it is. But they miss it because it literally is lost in translation. When I argued with him, he said, oh, no, it's in the footnote. Look at the footnote and said, that thing refers to nimitta. Just like when you sign a contract. It's in the footnotes. You didn't do things like that. But anyway, it's there, so you know it's there. You experience the nimitta as you breathe in and out. Now, when you first get a nimitta, I'll just go over a little bit. Experience this nimitta. You learn to brighten the nimitta, bring joy to the nimitta. Sampasadanang nimitta. Sampasadanang, it's this word which actually means actually bring joy, have confidence in it. It's a sort of the joy which you have with some sort of faith, confidence, like, you know, wow, this is really working, yeah, great. You're supposed to bring joy to it. But I prefer using that visual imagery of a nimitta actually to brighten it, make it just nice and clean and brilliant. And it does eventually become very, very brilliant. And for the person who maybe their precepts are not perfect, like I told this fellow in Kuala Lumpur, I said, look, you haven't been keeping your precepts, but you've got a nimitta coming up, a dirty old one. But out of compassion, I know all the loopholes. So I said, whenever you have an image like that, just have a look and you'll find there's one little part of that image which is more clean than the others. Zoom in on it. Like on Google Maps or something. Zoom in on it. And then all the other dirty parts will, you know, fall off the screen. They're off the radar. And you've got, you know, a much cleaner part of it. And on that cleaner part, get the most cleanest part of the cleaner part. Keep on zooming into the beautiful part. And when you zoom into the beautiful part, your nails will go more and more clean, more and more brilliant, more pure. That's how it's done. It's a positive mind state. If you're always negative, two bad bricks, you just keep zooming in on the faults, on the dirty parts. And that's where, you know, just that positive mind state, you know, the part of virtue is actually just comes to your assistance. Nimitta's, you go, the beautiful parts, and the beautiful parts of the beautiful parts, the beautiful parts of the beautiful parts of the beautiful parts, positive mind, and then it gets very pure. And also you bring brighten the nimitta, oh, you bring joy to the nimitta, and it has become very beautiful. It's so beautiful sometimes. It is the huge amounts of pleasure. And that's sometimes that's I love people to get those pleasures of the nimittas. Because they go, whoa, let's get in on this one. Because they think the religion is always really dull and boring. Spending 8-9 days meditating, 2 meals a day, no TV, no sex, no anything enjoyable. You must be crazy and you have to pay for that. But then when you start getting these nibbitas coming up, and whoa, this is great. So that's what happens. And then you settle them until you stir it. Because a lot of time that nibbita goes all over the place. Too much excitement or too much fear. And the... Are you okay if I just go another couple of minutes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then what happens is that to settle the nibbita, this is great Ajahn Chah gave this simile. And it was the simile of the still forest pool. As I heard it from his lips, he said, it's like when you go on these, like wandering the Tudong, a wandering monk, no staying too long in any one place. And then you usually find a place where there's a river or there is a lake, some body of water, a well. Because after walking through the jungles in Thailand, the forest, you get very dirty and sweaty, especially as a Westerner, not used to that climate. And so you really want to actually have a bath. And you want to sort of wash some of your robes, because they get stinky after a while. And if they get too stinky, you're not going to get any alms food the next day. there was one case in first year as a monk where we were very strict. We never would ask for anything. And so we ran out of soap. And so, we just wash in water, but, that didn't get, some of the grime and smell. And after 1 or 2 or 3 days, we never had needed to ask for anything, because after 1 or 2 or 3 days, the lay people on arms, I noticed we were just, a bit, hard on the nose. And they asked, what's going on? And so we ran out of soap. And that was the last time we ever ran out of soap. That's how it works. Anyway, so here's the still forest pool. That he said, after having a little bath, then you set up your mosquito net-like tent, and about 10 or 15 meters away from the edge of the lake. Because animals would come in the evening. And, it wasn't the fact you were afraid of the animals, because the animals never ate you. And, because you were calm, peaceful people. But he said what happened was that the animals wouldn't come near and they would go thirsty if they knew somebody was there. So instead, he said, 10, 15 meters from the edge of the lake. And then, he also told me, but be careful because sometimes the elephants come, especially with the young baby elephants. The young baby elephants are very playful. They see a little tent in there and maybe they go and put their trunk underneath the tent just to find out what's inside of there. And Ajahn Chah told me, he said, if that happens, the little elephant trunk comes in, bang it on the nose, on the snout. I said, that hurts it. I said, yeah, that's the only way to tell it to go, because if you play with it or if it stays with you too long, Mum will come. And she won't ask twice. So, because it's just mothers protecting their young. And of course, they do anything to protect their young. And even though you're not harming them at all, still they get scared and it's dangerous. So, there's all these stories you had to do when you're a forest monk. But anyway, he said, if you are sitting quietly there, sometimes he said, he would sit so peacefully with his eyes open. And then he'd see the forest animals come out to play by the still forest pool. Days before Nature Channel or National Geographic or whatever it is, there's amazing photographs of animals in the wild. And you see them come out As soon as they come out from the bush, the forest, they'll sniff around because they couldn't see very well. They could hear and smell. Those are the two main senses. If they smelt there was a human being there, they'd be terrified. Tigers were far more afraid of humans than humans of tigers. Many more tigers were killed by humans than humans killed by tigers. So they were the ones who were afraid, so they'd sniff around, listen. And if they didn't hear or smell anything, they'd come out with their young, play around. And he said it was a wonderful entertainment for a forest monk sometimes to sit there and watch all the animals come out to play. And they wouldn't know he was there. But if he made a noise, go, wow, or something, then they'd run away again. He had to be still for those animals to come and play by the pool. Nimittas, come and play by your mind. And if you make a noise, they will know you're watching. And they will go back into the bush, into the mind, they won't come out again. Wonderful simile. But then he took it the next level. He said sometimes that he was sitting there so still. And after the ordinary animals would come out and drink and play and wash by the forest pool, then these weird and beautiful and brilliant animals would come out. Animals which his parents, his teachers had never told him existed. Amazing animals. And they were really shy. He had to be so still for them to come out. And when they came out and they thought that I was watching, then they would play by the still forest pool. That was his metaphor for the jhanas. At this stage, it's a good way of looking. It's not real way of looking, a real simile, but it works. A way of visualizing what's going on. If your nimitta thinks you're watching it, it will go. If you try and do something with it, capture it, of course it will run away. You've got to be watching as if it doesn't know you're watching. And for the jhanas, you have to be so still, it's like no one is watching at all. Perfectly aware, but calm, motionless. Then the jhanas, they come out and play. Most amazing experiences, the like of which very few people know. Play by the still forest pool. Pool water is an archetypal simile for the mind. That's how it works. Still. So that's the Anapanasati so far. Okay. Sadhu. 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 Sadhu.